Hello, and welcome to the first of the Cemetery Tales. Cemetery Tales was made possible by a National Trust Inspire Writers Residency and funding from the Heritage Council of Western Australia. Unlike the audio walks available on other pages, you're not expected to listen to the stories as you walk through the area, and they're not written with walking in mind. You can listen to them anywhere. The East Perth Cemetery was surveyed in December 1829. Prior to that, the hill was known to the Whadjuk Noongar as Martalup. The East Perth cemeteries are on Aboriginal land. To begin, it helps to have a brief history of cemeteries and how that feeds into the development of East Perth. Traditionally, in England, the dead were buried in the local churchyard, unless they died far away from home. St James's Church in Piccadilly, London, is a good example of a typical churchyard, where today a weekday market is set up amongst the headstones. Nearby, Westminster Abbey contains the tombs and memorials of English nobility going back to the medieval era. The very wealthy and distinguished were entitled to be buried intramural, within the walls of the church, while the ordinary citizens were buried in the grounds. Any churchyard older than the 19th century will have its burial ground. Here in Perth, the graves surrounding where the original St Matthew's in Stirling Square in Guildford once sat are the surviving evidence of that custom. Two episodes were to change that practice, albeit slowly at first. One was the Great Fire of London in 1666. Over 80 churches, including the original St Paul's Cathedral, were destroyed in the inferno. Commissioned to redesign and rebuild many of the buildings, including St Paul's, Christopher Wren argued that churchyard burials softened the soil and foundations of churches, and the best place for graveyards was in zones set aside for that purpose outside the city. Everyone agreed with him, except London's council, which held the purse strings for Wren's reconstruction. But the idea that land should be set aside survived, to be argued and debated over the next 100 years. The other was the Reformation. There are really two of those in England. One, the Henrician, where famously Henry VIII founded the Church of England as a response to Rome's refusing to recognise his divorce from Catherine of Aragon in the 1520s. The second, unfolding concurrently, followed Martin Luther's Protestant Revolution in 1517. There was a flowering of Baptist and Anabaptist, Seeker and Quaker sects in the 17th century, and later Methodists and Presbyterians in the 18th. They didn't want to be buried in Anglican or Catholic churchyards, a stance that Catholics and Anglicans were more than happy to encourage. In 1665, John Tyndall bought land for a common cemetery, which is to say for people outside the mainstream faiths, at a place known as Bun Hill, which is a corruption of Bone Hill. Bun Hill Cemetery is in Islington, so inner London today, but back then outside the city boundaries. William Blake and John Bunyan are buried there. Gradually, the idea of a public cemetery, occupying its own space and where people of various faiths would be buried, took hold. By 1827, when plans to colonise the Swan River were being drawn up, a cemetery was regarded as an essential public utility, like sewerage and roads, and the responsibility of the government as much as the churches. And while society was still divided along religious grounds, a Catholic and a Protestant could occupy the same graveyard, just not necessarily right next to each other. But some ideas, dare I say it, take a long time dying. The sectarian divisions are still in place in the grounds. Anglicans surround the front of St Bartholomew's, forming a guard of honour between the gates and the chapel entrance, while Catholics and Wesleyans have their space behind the chapel. Another old tradition you'll find there is that most headstones in Christian cemeteries face east, following the belief that on Judgment Day, the dead shall be reborn facing the rising sun. And, common to cemeteries built during this period, East Perth is on a hill. The argument that people on a hill are closer to God may be one reason, but there's a more practical one, and that is to do with drainage. You really don't want a cemetery in a hollow, subject to flooding, especially if it's in the 1830s and you don't have the means to redirect water and seepage. At the same time, you don't want to put one on a hill so high that mourners and horses struggle to get up it. You can see why then, in 1830, East Perth was a logical spot for a cemetery. It was outside the town centre, but close enough to walk or ride to, on a hill, but not one that would deter most mourners, and it drained into the river. In fact, there's a social history we can read in three cemeteries in Perth, from East Perth, utilitarian, sited with practical issues foremost and relatively unadorned, to Karrakatta, which expresses the later Victorian ideal as the cemetery is a kind of park for the dead, with sculptured gardens under avenues of trees. When it opened in 1899, it was somewhere you'd want your loved ones to rest for eternity. Pinneroo, opened in 1978, took that idea further. Still a parkland, but one where the immediate signifier of death, the headstone, isn't apparent, and kangaroos are allowed to graze on lawns among natural bush, keeping with our more secular, ecologically conscious age. Incidentally, in the second half of the 19th century, it was customary across the denominations to have funerals on weekdays, but never on Sunday. That day was reserved for visiting the cemeteries, cleaning graves and laying fresh flowers. People put on their best outfits, or more likely didn't change out of the one they wore to church. And Sundays at East Perth cemeteries was a social occasion with people chatting around the headstones. If you spent evenings in your childhood sitting around telling ghost stories with your friends, you may have heard one regarding the Chipper family plot near the St. Bartholomew's church doorway. At some moment in the not too distant past, and for unknown reasons, a coffin of one of the children had to be disinterred. And when it was, the excavators discovered that her brilliant red hair, cut to standard length when she was buried, had continued to grow until it filled the box and was still as soft and lustrous as when she'd been alive. I don't think it's a true story. One reason being the girl's whose hair continues to grow after her burial is a standard trope in folklore around the world. But it tells us something about the way people regarded the cemetery, particularly in the days when it wasn't fenced off and we could visit day or night. Because it was the oldest cemetery and because it had a neglected look with slumping headstones and grass and weeds growing wild among the graves, it was easy to imagine a supernatural presence. You didn't even have to believe in ghosts to acknowledge that on the off chance they did exist and in Perth, this would be a logical place to find them. There's another urban legend. A man who doesn't believe in the supernatural accepts a bet to stay in a cemetery overnight. In standard versions, his friends turn up the next day, only to discover him dead, with an expression of utter terror frozen on his face. Something like this did happen at East Perth in 1920. In April that year, the Call newspaper ran an ad. "Are you afraid of ghosts? Man wanted to sleep all night alone in a graveyard from 10:30 p.m. Wednesday to daylight on Thursday, April 29. £5 for the night." The Call staff would drive the successful applicant to the cemetery with a bed, which would be brought into the graveyard and he would be chained to it. The person must spend the night absolutely alone, without even a dog for company, but may provide himself with gun or pistol to drive away any human disturbers. Over 500 people applied. The winner was a man named David Lord. The promoters thought he was perfect on the grounds he was a bronze Westralian who had been a boundary rider on the Murchison. On Wednesday evening, this strapping vision of young Australia was led to his bed. Camp stretcher, really. And perhaps he noticed that it was beside the headstone of a man also named Lord. The next morning, the crew went in to rescue the living Mr. Lord. He looked dishevelled and poorly slept, and it hadn't been an easy night. But I'll let him tell the story.
I was quite comfortable for a while until the awful stillness of this place began to impress upon me. I found myself listening intently for things I never heard, and there was a smell of mould in the air.
Things got worse.
I thought I heard a footstep behind me, but I couldn't see a thing in the darkness. I called out, but there was no answer.
But by now, Mr. Lord was soaked with sweat.
I happened to be lying, looking towards three big pine trees near the gate at the moment. The light shone through the boughs and mingled with the shadows on a white headstone, and it seemed to form the figure of a white-gowned woman. And with the movement of the trees, she seemed to bend forward and touch the head of the grave.
A second apparition wasn't as terrifying as that first one, though by this stage of the night, Mr. Lord was chain-smoking furiously. The mournful hoot of a nearby mopoke frayed his nerves even further.
To wake from nightmarish dreams and find oneself in a graveyard, I reckon, is calculated to disturb the peace of mind of anyone, and my waking thoughts were that I was dead and buried and I was my own ghost.
As philosophical fears go, that's about the worst you can have. A third apparition appears, and now Mr. Lord, bronzed West Australian bushman, screams with panic.
I struggled frantically, and then I fell. My head struck the tree, and the shock brought me to my senses. But it was a long time before I could convince myself that I had only been imagining things.
A cameraman, Fred Murphy, was on hand to film badly bruised Lord being released the next morning. And as it happens, a D.W. Griffith film, The Greatest Question, with Lillian Gish, was playing in town. A sentimental ghost story, it provided a perfect opportunity to show Murphy's footage and let Lord try to answer the greatest question with his own experiences. Sadly, Murphy's footage has been lost. But go to Trove and look up A Night in a Graveyard in The Call, April 30, 1920. And there's a photo of Lord lying in his bed beside the headstone, taken before fear reduced the stalwart bushman to a trembling wreck. The cemetery had already closed and fallen into disuse when David Lord stayed the night. People were being buried at Karrakatta or Fremantle or one of the outlying graveyards in the hills. In the next story, you'll hear about funerals, and one in particular that really showed the early colonists for what they were.